Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Dialogue Out Loud series. I'm Taylor Petrie, editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Today, we're excited to have with us Nicholas Schramm, a PhD student in religious studies at the University of Virginia. Nicholas holds a Master's of Religion from Yale Divinity School and a Bachelor's in American Studies from Brigham Young University. In his recent article, Materializing Faith and Politics, The Unseen Power of the NCCS Pocket Constitution in American Religion, he explores the role of this curious edition of the U.S. Constitution as an object of material religion. I love this fascinating article. Nicholas, welcome. It's so nice to talk to you about your work.
That's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the basics. What is the NCCS, or the National Center for Constitution Studies? What is the pocket constitution that they publish? And where did you see this document popping up in right-wing LDS political spaces?
Yeah, it is, like you said, it's a fascinating, unsuspecting piece of not just material culture, but, as I argue, material religion. The National Center for Constitutional Studies was founded early in the 1970s by Latter-day Saint writer, BYU instructor, professor, and Salt Lake City police chief Cleon Skousen. And it was originally called the Freeman Institute, which name comes from the Book of Mormon and the Book of Alma, about those that were opposed to the Kingmen. And so this early on, Freeman Institute has these connections to the John Birch Society. And so, but later on, because of the Freeman Institute's very Mormon connections, those associated with it noticed it was having a hard time making inroads with the religious right and the Mormon majority in the early 80s. And so it changes its name to the National Center for Constitutional Studies in an effort to seem less Mormon. And this organization from the beginning was dedicated to teaching Americans about what they saw as the true or the pure history of the United States, which to them was seen through the lens of a Judeo-Christian narrative of progress towards Republican democracy that saw the United States established as a Christian nation that has these divine roots. And so, and it continues today. It was originally headquartered in Provo, Utah, and then Salt Lake, and then Washington, D.C., and now in a very small town in southwestern Idaho. But they published, starting, this has been kind of part of the project, is to find out when these pocket constitutions come onto the scene. The earliest I can locate is in the late 80s, coinciding with the bicentennial of the U.S. Constitution. And these pocket constitutions are published by the NCCS, and they're distributed everywhere. And from the beginning, there's lots of organizations that are happy to distribute these pocket constitutions. I myself first encountered them when a family friend gave me a copy when I was 11 or 12 years old, and they told me, you might need this someday. I didn't know what that meant. I just looked at it and it was great, a pocket constitution, that's so cool. But that was it.
I think I actually had a very similar experience, that I came across them as a young age. I'm older than you, but I think in the late 80s or early 90s, I remembered seeing these and got one handed to me at a fair or a school event or something like that. They literally might have been handed out in schools at that point.
You know? Oh, yeah.
And so I have a very distinct memory of having one of these and even reading it as a young kid in the, you know, in the context of the 90s, I suppose. So it sort of emerges, as you say, as a kind of outgrowth and extension from the John Birch Society, and has these kind of LDS connections. And of course, latter people who know this history, Latter-day Saints were a big part of the John Birch Society, not only through Cleon Skousen, but also through Church President Ezra Taft Benson. Is that right?
Yeah, and there's connections. Ezra Taft Benson, from the earliest days of the Freeman Institute, supported its aims and its efforts. So yeah, there's pretty direct connections.
So it's not advertising itself as a Latter-day Saint version of this. It's meant to reach a broader audience, as you mentioned. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that they changed their name to the National Center for Constitution Studies. Does it still retain a strong LDS sort of leadership structure? I mean, obviously, that's not their main focus, but there are still a number of Latter-day Saints who are involved in the leadership.
Yeah, that's my understanding. And to me, the best evidence of that, there's a section of my piece that talks about literature that's advertised in the back of the pocket constitution that take on, they're authored by Latter-day Saints, like the real Thomas Jefferson, the real George Washington. And then they still publish a lot of Cleon Skousen's works from the 60s and 70s and 80s.
So like the Naked Communist and things along those lines, right?
Uh-huh, and the 5,000-year leap and the Making of America textbook from the 80s.
Yeah. So this is a really fascinating history of this organization and why they start publishing these. Are they the only group that you're aware of that's publishing these? Or, I mean, if you come across a pocket constitution, is it from this group?
So no, and that's actually something I wish that I probably should have talked about more in this piece, but I would dare to say that this is the most prominent and well-known pocket constitution, but there are actually quite a few organizations that publish them, including, I believe the U.S. federal government publishes its own version of pocket constitutions. And even though in this piece I argued that the materiality of these pocket constitutions has been more fully embraced by those on the right, there are plenty of instances of people on the left and, you know, Democratic senators and House of Representatives that use and invoke pocket constitutions as well, just not these ones particularly.
Okay, so that brings us to the sort of from the roots, I guess, of the NCCS and having these LDS roots here. You see it popping up in a number of right-wing LDS spaces. So can you tell us a little bit about those, where you see it happening, and some of the examples in the last 10 years or so that you mentioned in the article?
So I argue in the article in Dialogue that three of the most prominent instances of the pocket constitution from the NCCS being used first pop up with the Bundys in Nevada and then in Oregon, the first with Clive and Bundy's standoff against the Bureau of Land Management in southern Nevada, where Bundy and some of his associates bring weapons at the standoff because of these arguments and disputes over grazing riots in Idaho. And Lindsay Livingston, who is a scholar at BYU, writes this fascinating article about how the weapons themselves, the firearms, play this really important role in how people consumed the news of this standoff. And I'm heavily indebted to her thinking about the firearms, but equally prevalent, or at least prominent to me, were how they used pocket constitutions, these specific pocket constitutions. So if you do a scan of the news coverage of Clive and Bundy's standoff in 2014, you'll see that he's either holding NCS pocket constitutions or they're in his shirt pocket.
Poking out just a little bit.
It's just poking out. And so you'll notice on this particular pocket constitution, there's a portrait of George Washington that was painted for the bicentennial in 1988, I believe. And he, you know, George Washington's eyes just peer over the top of the pocket. The same thing happens in 2016 when Ammon Bundy takes over a wildlife refuge in Oregon. And in YouTube videos where he's speaking to his followers and people that, you know, when he's explaining why they're doing what they're doing, he makes sure that he has it in his pocket. And then one of my very favorites that I'm so grateful we got permission to use from, I believe it was USA Today, is this photograph of one of the people at the refuge named John Ritzheimer. And he's a former military man, and he has his photograph taken out of the window of his car. And to me, the first time I saw this, it just reminded me of in movies when, you know, national intelligence people are going to a base and it's all secretive, and they pull up to the station and somebody says, "Do you have your ID?" And, you know, they pull out their badge and they show it, and then they say, "Okay, move along." This is exactly what he's doing. And he has two things. The first is a photo, his phone turned landscape with a picture of his family. And then the other thing he's holding is the National Center for Constitutional Studies pocket constitution. Kind of like, these are the things that are important to me. These speak to who I am and kind of what I represent. And then the last one that I talk about, the part of the reason that I really got interested in this is because I was watching the Senate hearings on Trump's Supreme Court justice nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, and Senator Mike Lee from Utah, in one of his speeches supporting Amy Coney Barrett, he starts talking about the Constitution and, you know, that this is a thing that works when we use it correctly. And he brings out this pocket constitution and he holds it up. And a number of news outlets had taken photos of that, and some had even dug in to find out which copy of the pocket constitution and kind of discuss that. But it had the connections to Bundy hadn't quite been made. And, you know, but part of this project was then to see the connections and then that connection to that history with Skousen and Benson and this particular belief about American politics and constitutionality and, you know, the role of the United States in God's plan and that kind of thing that this pocket constitution means to these people that use them.
So those images are thankfully in the article for anybody who wants to check them out. There's one other image that you discuss, and I don't recall if it's in the article or not, but you talk about the LDS propagandist painter, John McNaughton. And he may be well known to people who are aware of this, but he publishes a lot of kind of controversial right-wing imagery. There's one where he actually has the Freeman or the NCCS pocket constitution sort of in the painting. And can you remind us of what that scene is?
Yeah, so this is a tiny bit of background that might be helpful. This article is actually an expansion and a development of one of my chapters of my master's thesis at Yale Divinity School. And it was about multimedia Mormon American nationalism from roughly the 70s to the present day. And that thesis started out of me writing about John McNaughton's artwork. And as I was coming across various what I call religio-political paintings, he has one of Cliven Bundy on a horse holding a flag and also with the pocket constitution in his pocket. And he writes about, this is McNaughton, writes about going down to Nevada and visiting with Cliven Bundy and speaking with him about his plight and, you know, the things that he'd been going through, and really admired him and decided to paint this portrait of him and always made sure to include the pocket constitution.
So this isn't just a symbol of attention to the Constitution specifically, but you connect it to a kind of theory of an inspired Constitution that you see showing up in LDS historical sources as well. Can you tell us a little bit about inspired Constitution theories, how they sort of overlap with LDS ideas?
Yeah, so a big part of this piece is I felt necessary to discuss at least some Latter-day Saint views of the Constitution. And as we recently saw just a few years ago after, I think it was April 2021 General Conference, President Dallin H. Oaks gave a talk about our divinely inspired Constitution, which is just the most recent iteration of a closely held belief. Some might say doctrine, right? As it's found in the Doctrine and Covenants, about the divinity of the U.S. Constitution. And basically the narrative goes as it's portrayed in literature from the NCCS to LDS gospel manual, Sunday school manuals, is that in order for the restoration of the church to happen, there needed to be a land of liberty, a place where people could practice their religion freely. And so God, through the ages, set up this plan so that there could be a country, a land where people could practice their religion. And Joseph Smith, in one of his revelations that's now canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants, talks about how the Lord made this divine document and raised up the people that wrote it. And so since then, that has taken on both in very like official church discourse and also more folklore-y type discourse that Christopher Blythe has talked about quite a bit in his book, Terrible Revolution, that there's this understanding of the Constitution as divine. And as scholars of religion know, that once something has been designated as sacred, it's always either at risk or it's something that needs to be protected. And so there's a lot of theory or narrative about how the Constitution has constantly been at risk, which leads to things that relate to the White Horse Prophecy, which has been quite well misunderstood over the last several decades, but this, you know, connected to these revelations that Joseph Smith purportedly gave about the Constitution will one day hang by a thread, and Bundy, Cliven and Ammon Bundy and Ezra Taft Benson and Skousen all, you know, evoke this type of narrative quite regularly, and about how there's a specific role for Latter-day Saints to protect the Constitution, something that the Freeman Institute and the National Center for Constitutional Studies has seen themselves kind of taking on that role, placing themselves into that narrative that they've held on to so strongly for decades, right? And that's on the more right-wing parts sides of it, but this is a pretty widespread belief and an attachment that I think, you know, conceivably could go all the way into more left-wing parts of the church, just depending on how one wants to interpret the divinity of the Constitution.
Yeah. So in at least in these circles, it comes to take on a kind of quasi-scriptural status, a kind of another canonical work here. And as you said, it needs to be protected against risk. And these Latter-day Saints have come to see themselves as the protectors of it. And therefore, you know, publishing it, disseminating it, waving it around in Senate hearings, right? These become performative actions for doing this kind of defense of the Constitution, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And connected to these more constitutional theories, and I don't know if you were going to ask about, I think you might have mentioned like material religion. And that's another really important touchstone for me in this piece, is thinking about that this isn't just it isn't just something that is a product of a particular world. It takes on its own status and then itself starts to produce its own narratives. Right. And so one could look at the pocket constitution and say, you know, as one is holding it, and say, oh, well, there's a history attached to that, which there absolutely is, because of its performance and because of its materiality and the way that it's being used and consumed and then viewed, both on TV and in newspapers and what have you. It starts to produce its own narrative, right? That this is actually something that's central to people's practiced faith, right? And I think that that's something that is interesting to think about, that it is something that's visible and tangible in the world that people have both put into it, but then also kind of starts to take on its own through performance and can be, and then will influence what happens after with it.
So you've talked about this concept of material religion here, and for many of our listeners, they might not be familiar with it because it's not an everyday term. It's a term of scholarship that has developed over the last couple of decades. And it is, as I understand, along the lines of what you're talking about, where we're not just talking about a concept of the Constitution. We're now talking about a material object that sort of has its own power here, and that it's not, it is in the show, like showing of it, the wearing of it, the, you know, waving it around, like that these actions with this material object have their own kind of religious significance. Can you maybe want to expand on this, or if you have more to say about like what we mean by material religion, what you mean by material religion, and how you see this document, which seems on the surface to be a sort of a secular text, right? But how it has come to be an object of material religion.
Yeah, I think that material religion is a really productive and fruitful place to play in religious studies because and I'm not totally versed in the historiography of material religion. From what I understand, there's this material turn that happens in religious studies, you know, a couple of decades ago that one of the interlocutors that I have in the piece is Birgit Meyer that says that, quote, a materialized study of religion begins with the assumption that things, their use, their valuation, and their appeal are not something added to a religion, but rather inextricable from it. And then elsewhere, that religion cannot persist or thrive without the material things that serve to make it present. So like you said, that religion isn't just thoughts. It's not just ideas. Religion is something that can actually take place. It can be evoked in physical, tangible objects. And so it is really interesting that you would say that, okay, the U.S. Constitution is something that's seemingly secular or godless, as it's been accused of being. It almost doesn't matter. It almost doesn't matter, even if the NCCS pocket constitution, and it is, as I'd argue, it's carefully curated to put religious significance into the constitution. It has stuff at the beginning about quotes from Washington and others about how they understood the Constitution being divinely inspired. But even if it was any other pocket constitution that doesn't have that additional curation and it's just the plain text of the original Constitution, people in, you know, working with material religious theory could make the argument, and I want to make it here, is that even if it doesn't have that those additions, it can still be religion. It can still be these things that people hold on to. And in the cases of Ammon and Clive and Bundy, and I would argue Mike Lee as well, it's religion. And you don't have to go find, you know, God or divinity or Jesus in the text or creator in the text of the Constitution. The way that it's being used and the way that the people that are using it and also people that are receiving it, it becomes religious. It's tied to the object. It's not just the idea of a divinely inspired constitution. It's they're treating these actual pocket constitutions with a lot of reverence. They're giving it a lot of respect. They're making sure that it is right side along, you know, their weapons and pictures of their family and other things that they would deem sacred.
So you connect this not just to the LDS case of the kind of materialization or the religious significance of the Constitution as a material object here, but also to broader trends in Christian nationalism in general, both in terms of ideology and in terms of approach to the U.S. Constitution, to a sacred history of the United States. How does this case relate to that? And what do cases like this tell scholars and other observers about the interrelationship between religion and politics?
That's a really good question. And I don't know that I have a really good answer for it yet. It is one of my big questions and interests that I have. In fact, one of the goals of the thesis that I wrote at Yale Divinity School was trying to figure out how much Mormonism influenced what people have, you know, what scholars and even, you know, media outlets have started to identify as Christian nationalism. How much of that can be contributed to Mormonism? And vice versa, how much of what I would call like Mormon American nationalism, you know, these, you know, divinely inspired constitutions and alignment with the religious right and moral majority.
Why do you flip on that one?
Yeah. And Christian coalition. How much of that is impacting how those things are understood and practiced within Mormonism? So, for instance, how much of Ezra Taft Benson's and Cleon Skousen's worldviews are impacted by these broader discourses and things happening in American religious history versus how much is Mormonism contributing. And I don't know that I have a good answer for that, but I will say that I think that this case study is an interesting piece to that puzzle, because it does show that this is, I think I call it again, seemingly it kind of just found its way into the conversation. There's a really interesting story where some Florida school districts were purchasing thousands of these pocket constitutions and placing them into schools. And then a judge in Florida cast it out, saying, no, we can't have this because of the material that's been curated in it. And it specifically has this Mormon context that it comes from. And so it's a puzzle that I think scholars are still trying to figure out, but hopefully this can be at least a piece of the puzzle that Mormons have made a contribution to what is being understood as Christian nationalism. And I have lots of quibbles with that term, and especially with how, especially the sociology of religion that deals with Christian nationalism, how they do or do not incorporate Mormonism into their calculus. And so hopefully this can be a contribution there to push people on thinking a little bit more nuanced about that.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Nicholas. It's been a huge pleasure to have you and to learn more about this project.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope that our listeners have enjoyed this conversation and have learned something new. If you'd like to learn more, check out Nicholas Schrum, Materializing Faith and Politics, The Unseen Power of the NCCS Pocket Constitution in American Religion, in the summer 2024 issue of Dialogue. And you can also explore further resources on this topic there as well. To our listeners, thanks for joining us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and colleagues, and don't forget to leave us a review or get in touch with any comments or questions. We hope that you'll tune in for future episodes of our podcast. Please subscribe and rate the show, and be sure to check out the whole range of shows in the Dialogue Podcast Network. Thanks.
Beyond the Block, part of the Dialogue Podcast Network, is a weekly Come Follow Me podcast that centers the marginalized in Mormonism. Join Brother Jones and Brother Knox, a Black lifelong member and a queer convert theologian, respectively, as they read the scriptures through the lenses of their identities and others in an effort to bring the culture of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints closer and more in line with its theology, which centers Christ's justice and compassion. New episodes every Monday.
Dialogue Podcast Network.